Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you with us today. In this hour, we'll explore the decision by the NFL to suspend star running back Ray Rice indefinitely and take a look at how the league's domestic violence policy compares to that of other workplaces across America, and how the Department of Energy wants to put cyborg insects to work. But we begin this hour with a big picture look at America's understanding of itself in the world and how it's changed dramatically over the last century. In the 1920s and 30s, in the wake of World War I, the U.S. declined to join the League of Nations. It focused instead on domestic challenges, turned inward rather than face the rise of fascism in Europe. For Dr. Henry Kissinger, America's inward turn had great personal impact. The former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor and his family suffered persecution as Jews in Nazi Germany and fled to the United States in 1938 when he was 15 years old. Since he began his career in foreign policy, Henry Kissinger has been known as a realist, a champion of hard practicality in world affairs and the pursuit of American goals above all else. But in his latest book, Kissinger tempers that foreign policy outlook with a nod to idealism and a belief in America's moral vision, as he argues that the U.S. has to take the lead in the face of Islamic terrorist threats like ISIS and a resurgent Russia. Henry Kissinger's latest book is called World Order, and he joins me now in the studio. Mr. Secretary, thank you for being here.
Great pleasure to be here.
The scope of your book is very broad, and I thought today would be a good day to focus on the current crisis with the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, ISIS, as they're called. The president will give a speech tomorrow laying out U.S. strategy there. Saudi Arabia is going to be a key part of the emerging coalition here, and in your book you really place Saudi Arabia at the center of the modern Islamic State dilemma, Western leaning in partnership with the U.S. both politically and economically, but also the standard bearer of Islamic Sunni theocracy and jihad. So now with the threat of ISIS, what does this moment mean for Saudi Arabia and the contours of the Middle East as you see it?
Well, Saudi Arabia historically has never agreed that any one point is the turning point. And it has considered surviving the various crises its principal objectives. But now it finds itself in an extremely difficult position. It is overwhelmingly afraid of the rise of Shia power in the region, which means Iran. But it is also threatened by Sunni fanaticism, which threatens its entire structure domestically. They will have to decide, and I think they will decide, that they will have to back the war against ISIS. But then we will face a second round of issues when Iran becomes dominant in the news cycles again.
Sticking with Iran for the moment, and I want to look at Iran maybe through the lens of the United States, you talk at length in the book about nuclear talks with Iran that are going on now with a deadline next month and the opportunity that lies in those talks. But you also describe Iran in detail as the standard bearer of Shiite jihadism, and really make a suggestion that regardless of the outcome of nuclear talks, that the fundamental incentives for Iran don't really change. You use the example, which I think is the Ayatollah's own example, just because a wrestler is flexible doesn't mean he's forgotten who his opponent is.
That's a direct quote from the supreme leader of Iran.
Yes.
Explaining his negotiations with the United States.
And that suggests that even if nuclear talks are successful, we shouldn't take too much of a message of reform.
First of all, I think a successful negotiation on nuclear matters is very problematical because the position of the two sides are fundamentally very far apart. And with respect to that, one has to ask oneself, what is one trying to achieve? And then, secondly, Iran, independent of the nuclear negotiations, has really three patterns of its own history that it can theoretically choose from. One, the period before the Ayatollahs came in, when it was a national state concerned with traditional aspects of national security, not intervening in affairs of its neighbors except along the lines that European states had impacted on each other. The second is an empire that governed large areas of North Africa and all of the Middle East for a period.
The Persian Empire.
The Persian Empire. And the third is the center of jihadism. In the period since 1979, when they came into office, we have seen a combination of imperial Persian policy and jihadist policies. So if they maintain that position, then a nuclear agreement by itself will not bring about a change in the impact they have and the threat that they represent. So the question is a psychological one. Are they capable? Which of these models are they going to follow? So they are not defeated in the negotiations.
Merely flexible, as the Ayatollah said, and you quoted, in a wrestling match.
Right. Maybe. We should be open to a political change, but we shouldn't gamble our hope. We should see whether there are concrete results.
Well, then, looking more broadly then, what is the moment of opportunity for the United States and the Middle East at this moment, if there is one? You're describing a situation that's remarkable between the Saudis and the Iranians in their discussions, but probably a temporary alliance based on a one focal threat and not really a strategic change. You're describing an Iran, in your view, that is at the table with nuclear talks, but not changing its fundamental worldview.
Maybe
not changing its worldview or its incentives. Is there a real opportunity in crisis for the United States now, or are we just checking boxes here?
No, what we're seeing in the Middle East is a number of revolutions going on concurrently. There is the revolution, internal revolution, in almost every state that occurs. There is the conflict between Shia and Sunni. There is the conflict between various sectarian groups, even beyond the Shia-Sunni conflict, of which Syria is a classic example, and now Libya. And then there is an attack on the international system that was created in 1920 at the end of World War I, and where the borders do not reflect anything except a sphere of influence between Britain and France of that period. So all of these crises are going on simultaneously. It has many similarities to the European 30 Years' War 400 years ago. At the end of that war, they came up with an agreement with what was called the Treaty of Westphalia, which, quite in contrast to the previous period, established a number of principles which more or less governed the relationship of European states for 300 years. Now, is it possible to create an equivalent of such a system? That is the challenge for the United States and for others. We alone can't do it. A world without balance of power is an arbitrary world, and the nature of the balance of power will change. But the principle that you cannot have one region or one country dominate the whole world will reemerge, or should reemerge.
Well, you exercised the balance of power for many, many years as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, and so many people are interested in your history, and echoes of it come out in your book. And I wanted to ask you about that. You know, one passage in your book says that idealism is a critical part of American policy, but that the most sustainable course will evolve a blend of realism and idealism, too often held out in the American debate as incompatible opposites. And it made me think of your history in places like Chile. Was it the case that realism trumped democratic idealism there when you engineered the coup against Salvador Allende? Was that an example of that?
You know, one trouble with discussions of this type is you're referring to an event that happened 50 years ago. And so it's very hard to reconstruct.
40, yes.
Or 40 years ago. Very hard to reconstruct. The fact is, I did not engineer a coup against Allende. Allende was overthrown by his military, with whom he had no contact, 2 years earlier or 3 years earlier when he came in.
The head of the Chilean Army General René Schneider was assassinated in his car.
That was
pursuant to a CIA operation that you did help initiate, that you said you turned off, but that you did help initiate.
That was 3 years earlier.
Correct.
It was not an operation that we initiated. It was not planned as an assassination. And we turned it off once we became aware. But that happened 3 years earlier. That was not in connection with this.
And many other people testified in front of the Church Commission in the Senate later on that, in fact, you were well informed of that operation, even after officially turning it off in
a
memo.
Look, let me tell you something here. It's an issue that your audience cannot possibly know much about. This happened over 40 years ago. It has been exhaustively discussed. It is a reflection of a period in which the divisions in America were so great that opponents seemed to take a perverse pleasure in charging the people with whom they disagreed on other points with sort of criminal activities. And to have a meaningful discussion, you have to begin with the premise that serious people are trying to do the best for their country. We have been trying to overthrow President Assad. We overthrew in this administration. We supported and took military action in Libya for that purpose. That America has an interest in bringing about democratic governments is a well-established fact. What the details were in 1971, with all due respect to you, it's not an appropriate subject here because it's easy to fish out individual statements before committees. I think our national debate would be helped if we assumed that serious people were trying to achieve serious objectives and to ask what these objectives were and not to see whether there is one act taken by some outlying CIA group.
We have much more with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, including the history of his own policies in Cambodia, the controversy over the declassification of his own documents, and what he's learned after his many years in public service as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor. You can find it all on the website at thetakeaway.org, my entire interview with former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, some 20 or 21 minutes long. Please check it out at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Well, it's a video that by now you've either seen or at least heard about. Shocking images of NFL star running back Ray Rice punching his then-fiancée in an elevator, then dragging her limp body out, all while looking unfazed by his actions. That video surfaced yesterday and resulted in the Baltimore Ravens dropping Rice from their roster and the NFL suspending him indefinitely. But is it too little too late from a league who back in July suspended Rice for only 2 games? That was after seeing only part of the video, which the league maintains they never saw in full until yesterday. Lots of strong reactions have been pouring out since NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell's announcement. Former Vikings linebacker Ben Lieber said not to take attention away from Ray Rice, but Goodell and his suits saw the elevator video in July. They need to be held accountable as well. Assistant coach for the Chicago Bears, Chris Harris, said the NFL should have zero tolerance for domestic violence. There is never a reason for any man to be violent toward any woman. Former linebacker Coy Wire, I'd be damned if I had to be associated with him. So how does the NFL policy, such as it is now, on domestic abuse compare to policies in other workplaces in this country? We want to explore that very question now with Maya Ragu. She's senior attorney with Futures Without Violence, a nonprofit dedicated to ending violence against women, children, and families. Maya, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You know, a lot of people on Twitter and other places since the Ray Rice incident and firing in these last couple of days have said, well, if Ray Rice worked for any other employer, he would have been gone long ago. Is that really true?
Well, you know, I wish I could say it was, but it's not. And the way that workplaces have sort of responded to the issue of domestic and sexual violence has really varied pretty widely across industries and across sizes of companies. It's just unfortunate that it's taken a graphic video of a man punching a woman to get a response or to sort of make people aware of this issue.
Well, the workplace policies that are out there currently say what?
Well, it's a couple of different things. Policies that are good policies or that we think are good policies are those that take sort of a proactive approach, right? They're looking at not only responding to employees who are victims of violence or who perpetrate violence, but thinking about prevention. How do we stop these sort of things from happening, or how do we reach out and make sure people who need help are getting connected to resources?
So how does it work in practicality in the regular working world, not in the world of the NFL, which is in the public eye and doesn't have the same PR concerns that maybe the Baltimore Ravens have with a star like Ray Rice? How does it work in the real world if a boss hears through the grapevine that his employee in accounting beat his wife after a night out on Friday night?
Well, the key here, right, in any policy dealing with this issue is the employer has to make a decision about to what extent is this behavior affecting the workplace. And what is sort of the tie to the workplace? If someone is engaging in that sort of behavior away from the workplace and there aren't any performance issues and they're not using work time and work resources to commit that criminal activity, then a lot of employers, that's where they've chosen to draw the line and saying, you know, what can we really do in that particular instance except to condemn that sort of behavior? We don't know if we really have a right to penalize or punish someone for what's going on in their private life. Now, if that person gets arrested and is facing criminal charges, that can be a separate matter. The employer can say, you know what, we take this issue seriously. Employees who engage in any kind of criminal behavior, here are the penalties for that, regardless of whether you're actually convicted or not. With some employers, they say, you know what, we take this issue so seriously that even if this isn't having an impact on the workplace, in terms of performance or healthcare costs or any other thing, we just won't tolerate that. It's really sort of a choice for employers on how strongly they want to address this issue and be proactive and establish from the get-go that there's a culture of respect in their workplace on all kinds of issues, not just domestic violence, sexual harassment, sexual violence, bullying, anything.
Well, what businesses that we may have heard of, companies that are familiar to Americans, have these types of policies and are doing it right, in your view?
A lot of different industries. And not surprisingly, I think the first companies that did it were the ones who had a lot of female employees or whose businesses are open to the public. So, for example, in retail, Liz Claiborne, Avon were the early ones, American Express. And nowadays, I know Williams-Sonoma, which has stores all over the country, has a good policy. Similarly, you know, the federal government now is encouraging federal agencies to have policies. So the Department of Justice, which has over 100,000 employees, some of whom are law enforcement, some of whom, you know, out in the field, some of whom are lawyers in offices, they have a good policy and they're doing training. And I know also that the American Bar Association recently adopted a resolution encouraging its 400,000 plus members who are in all sorts of companies to adopt policies to address this issue.
Still, only about a third of all workplaces address this issue at all. Is that right? Is that not a valid number?
Right. Only about 30% of companies have policies that address all kinds of workplace violence, let alone domestic violence.
Well, as an attorney who handles these issues, Maya Rigu, how do you see the Baltimore Ravens and the NFL from where you sit as an employer? You know, it's one thing to say an employer considered this behavior completely unacceptable and got rid of somebody who wasn't behaving according to the standards of their industry. That doesn't really appear to be the case here. It really appears that the Baltimore Ravens football team realized that that video was a PR nightmare, that it was horrific, that they had to be decisive and big with their response, and that the NFL, after seeing the second video, thought the same thing. That's kind of different than having a proactive policy.
Right, absolutely. It was pretty reactive to the release of the video. I mean, certainly firing him and suspending him indefinitely from the NFL does send an important message about accountability and that there are non-criminal consequences for domestic and sexual violence, for engaging in those sorts of action. But you're right. I mean, this is just one incident, and it's one that happened to be caught on tape. So the real test is, going forward, how does the NFL handle domestic and sexual violence incidents involving players that happen away from the camera and away from the public eye? And certainly there have been a lot of them before this, and there will continue to be some afterwards.
And the broader issue there is how do workplaces all across the country that don't have a star or PR element handle their issues when it comes to domestic violence? Maya Raghu, senior attorney with Futures Without Violence, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you. There's new livestock in town helping scientists detect radiation levels or find people underneath rubble. It's the much maligned cockroach. A team at NC State University has figured out how to remotely control cockroaches and equip them with tiny electronic backpacks and sensors. Alper Boskert is assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering, and he leads this research on roach biobots and joins us now. Professor, welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Why do cockroaches have to do all the work? Why'd you choose them?
Basically, it has been a dream for robotics engineers to build a very small centimeter or inch scale robots, and unfortunately we do not have that capability. And when we look at the history, before having our cars or our motorcycles, we have been using horses or oxen, so we have been benefiting from the muscle power of the animals. Now we are looking at the same strategy, and we are trying to use the cockroach's muscle power to carry our tiny payloads for us.
I'm going to guess the cockroach does not respond to training and reward the same way an ox or a horse does. So how do you get them to go where you need them to go?
What we do is we directly implant electrodes to their neural system, to their sensors, and we send really tiny pulses to stimulate those regions. And this basically creates an artificial or visual image in front of the cockroach, and it tries to avoid that.
And you can steer a cockroach in this way? You can make a cockroach go left, right, go forward?
Yes, we can draw a line on the ground, an S-shaped line, and we can make the cockroach closely follow that. And we don't have any human control. Computers see where the cockroach is, and then it sends the command signals, and it makes the cockroach to follow the line.
Well, the Department of Energy is interested in what you're doing. What are you going to be up to with the government?
So one of the things that we are planning to use this for is trying to find out whether there is any leakage in a nuclear plant or not. They carry tiny sensors, and whatever sensor you put on it, it becomes useful for something. And in this application, we are planning to put tiny radiation detectors, and we try to look for the leakages in nuclear-based storage facilities.
Professor Alper Boskert, assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at North Carolina State University. You know, people are going to roll their eyes when I talk about ethics with cockroaches, but, you know, we train dolphins to detect harbor mines, train dogs certainly to sniff out drugs and bombs and do all kinds of work for us. People have very little problem with working animals, but these animals you're not training, you're taking over their minds. You're playing puppet master with them. Is there an ethical dimension to what you're doing?
First of all, people are generally okay with working animals as long as we are not hurting them. And biologically, there is no way we can hurt a cockroach in the sense that they don't have the pain receptors as we have it, and they don't have the necessary pain circuits. Therefore, it is suggested that they don't perceive the pain as we experience it. And the second thing is we are actually trying to promote this understanding to respect animals, especially insects. We kill insects very easily in our homes, but they have a role in our ecosystem. And we try to promote this respect towards insects. You know what happened when the bees disappeared from our ecosystem a couple of years ago? So cockroaches has a role, even if we don't appreciate it. And they are beautiful when you look at their design. As engineers, we are amazed with the structure and function of these little creepy crawlers.
Well, please do not pet the seeing eye dogs and bomb sniffing dogs that you see in public places. And please don't pet Alper Bozkurt's cockroaches. Little tiny vests for them, Professor, please?
Yes, we are basically building tiny backpacks.
We'll look forward to seeing the design of those too. Alper Bozkurt, Assistant Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at NC State University. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, we're going to end this hour right where we started with U.S. foreign policy. Tomorrow night, in prime time, President Obama will lay out the White House's plans for waging a long-term campaign against ISIS. It's an effort that would draw on the resources of a coalition of partners across the Middle East. But is the need to fight the common enemy, changing alliances and shifting power in the Middle East? We covered this a bit with Henry Kissinger at the top of the hour. Could Saudi Arabia forge new partnerships with Iran and Qatar? And where will U.S. efforts fit in along this shifting landscape? For another view, Robin Wright. She's a distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World, and of course, a former reporter at the Washington Post. Robin, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you.
Let me play you a piece of tape from retired General Wesley Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO in Europe. He was on this program yesterday, and he said something remarkable about the Middle East and the fight against ISIS. Listen.
In the last week, the Saudi leadership has met privately with the Qatari leadership. They flew in. There was no news about it in the press in the United States. We knew about it, of course, behind the scenes because they were trying to patch over their quarrel between two branches of Wahhabi Sunnism. And this week, the Saudis met actually with the Iranians because the Saudis and the Iranians agree that ISIS is a threat.
Robin, that was a remarkable statement. The Saudis and the Iranians have met and are meeting, part of the remarkable coalition that may be taking shape with the U.S. sort of taking a back seat.
Well, the coalition really is the centerpiece of what the United States is trying to do. It wants to build a coalition for a lot of reasons, to help give credibility, bestow legitimacy on the United States intervention for a third time in Iraq. It also wants to help defray the costs. It's turning to the Saudis and other oil-rich Gulf countries to play a role like they did in picking up the tab of Operation Desert Storm, pushing Iraq out of Kuwait. But it also wants to mobilize the Sunni world in order to have some means of communicating with the Sunnis inside Iraq. That is the core of the problem. The Sunnis now feel marginalized, isolated by the Shiite-dominated government. And the United States wants to see the Sunnis be the vehicle in sending the message to the Sunnis to turn against ISIS, to rise up against them, as the Sunnis did so effectively in forcing al-Qaeda out of Iraq in 2007. Now, part of that will also mean that you have to bring together a lot of players in the Middle East. And so that's where you get the unlikely countries of Saudi Arabia and Iran actually talking to each other. But everybody in the Middle East is very afraid of the way that the Islamic State is not only reconfiguring borders, but posing a real strategic and security challenge to virtually every country in the region.
Well, ISIS is, of course, a highly ideological Sunni faction sweeping across Syria and Iraq, as you mentioned. At first glance, one might think that Saudi Arabia, the guardians of Sunni Wahhabism, might be kind of okay with it, at least ideologically. What threat does ISIS pose to Saudi Arabia?
Well, remember, just like al-Qaeda, ISIS wants to reshape the Islamic world. It wants to reintroduce the idea of a caliphate. And it wants a much stricter or purer rule than in Saudi Arabia. It's hard to imagine in some ways, but it is as opposed to Saudi Arabia as Osama bin Laden was. And so we're coming full cycle again. We're seeing the same issues that emerged out of Operation Desert Storm almost a quarter century ago emerging today.
Well, Robin Wright, Saudi Arabia talking with its old enemy, Iran, and these two branches of Islam, the conflict goes back 1,000 years or more, nothing new. Is this a sign of a fundamental shift in the balance of power in the Mideast, or is it a case where two enemies have a common enemy, they can cooperate on Monday, and on Tuesday they'll be right back to proxy wars, terrorism, and mutual animosity?
Oh, the core tensions still exist. There are reasons for Saudi Arabia and Iran to have common agenda in ousting the Islamic State. But when it comes to the future of Iraq, you see some of these core differences. Saudi Arabia does not want to see a purely Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad. And, of course, Iran wants to see a friendly government in Baghdad. And that means that the Shiites have to play a very important, if not dominant, role. So you have a core tension that will reemerge down the road.
There is that core tension, but then one has to ask what the opportunity is in this crisis for the United States. 6 months ago, the United States fomenting a coalition of these countries in the Middle East was unthinkable, really, for any reason. The depth of the crisis now has Saudi Arabia talking to Iran and Qatar as well. What's the opportunity here for the U.S. as it sort of looks maybe longer term at this shape of the Middle East?
There's something very interesting going on already, and that is the United States has been talking to Iran about its controversial nuclear program, and the deadline for that is November 24th. And on the sidelines of these meetings that happen at least once a month, there have been talks between the Iranians and the Americans in a very minor way, no big new initiatives, but at least discussing the fact that Iraq is being destabilized, the problems of Syria. So this is not off the radar, and bettering relations with Iran over its nuclear programs would go a long way to bringing Iran back into the region. So there's a lot of kind of shifting players, shifting moods.
But today, of course, Robin Wright, you're writing starkly about the risks to the United States of getting involved, the risks to the United States even having an Arab or a Muslim coalition in the lead against ISIS. What are the major risks that you see?
Well, the United States is relying first and foremost on the Iraqi government, and it was finally formed late Monday night. The problem is there are still a lot of disputes within this new government, and they still don't have a defense minister. They still don't have an interior minister, and these are the two pivotal positions in national security at a time that a third of the country has been literally seized by the Islamic State. The second vulnerability is the fact that the United States will rely on Iraqi forces themselves to actually fight on the ground. But so far, the major players on the ground have been the Kurdish militia and three Shiite militias, not the Iraqi army, which lost four divisions in the early sweep by ISIS across western Iraq. And the danger is that we can't retrain, reinvigorate, recreate the Iraqi military fast enough to take the lead in this, and that therefore the militias end up playing more of a role, wanting more of the rewards, the perks of military engaging and of taking back territory. And this lays the groundwork for friction down the road. This is going to be a very long process.
Robin Wright is distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and at the U.S. Institute of Peace. She has a piece online in today's New Yorker called The Risks. Robin Wright, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, before we leave you for this hour, we want to remind you to join the Takeaway Book Club. Summer's not over. This month's pick, The Lobster Kings by Alexei Zenter. This is a modern-day retelling of Shakespeare's King Lear, but it's set off the coast of Maine, where a young heroine vies for the family legacy. That's lobster fishing. Well, this month, Takeaway listeners Linda, Carol, and Jonathan help us read through the book and its themes of community and nature and family. They are part of the Middle of the Book Club from Middlebrook, Virginia.
I felt that the pace of the book very much mimicked the pace of the movement of the sea, quiet waves and crashing waves and calmness and storms.
King Lear wandering the moors in a thunderstorm. How about on the high seas off the coast of Maine? There's technically a few more weeks of summer. It's not over. So read along with us as you enjoy your last trip to the beach, maybe, or maybe a trip to the cafe with your summer reading book. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. John Hockenberry will be back tomorrow. It's been a pleasure being with you these last few days. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.